The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Greg Cockcroft from the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is The Atlantic. For the next half hour, I will be reading to you from The Atlantic magazine. Our first article today is entitled, My Friend Was in the Valley. This is written by Annette Sanuk Clapsaddle. The last text message I received on Friday morning from Josh, a close friend since kindergarten, read, I just had to wade in waist-deep water to rescue my dog. Everything I own is ruined. I'm a bit emotional. Sorry, I need a minute. Cell service dropped. Wi-Fi signal disappeared. Josh lives 12 minutes from my house, which is near Cherokee, North Carolina. That short stretch of land and water between us made all the difference this week. Scott's Creek, which runs right by Josh's house and is usually benign enough, swelled and formed a deadly confluence with the Tuskegee River. And Dillsboro, his tiny community, just a few blocks in total, was submerged beneath the floodwaters that Hurricane Helene induced. I was on the mountain, and my friend was in the valley. I'd promised myself I would never be here again, caught in a 100, maybe 1,000-year flood. This time, I was far from my eastern Kentucky friends and their scarred banks, still mending from the devastating flood of 2022. These western North Carolina highlands, largely protected from extensive mining extraction, would protect me and others who call them home. And from my front porch, these mountains of my home did hold. These riverbanks were true. These creeks culled most swells. They kept my promise. My front yard today does not look like the ones I drove past in 2022 when I fled Hindman, Kentucky, a hazy dawn lighting my way on that late July morning. What I can't quite reckon with is that my neighbor's yards do. 12 minutes down the road, an hour east in Asheville, or just a bit further in Boone, and most of the communities in between. Sporadic pictures filtering through spotty Wi-Fi service look remarkably similar to the calls for help from 2 years ago in the Bluegrass State. Death tolls climb. Even in Cherokee, people are making runs on gas. Boil water advisories are in effect regionally. Friends can't locate family. My promise might have helped quell my fears, but promises are premised on what has come before, and what seems reasonable and possible. In Cherokee, we have become accustomed to hearing the phrase for over 10,000 years. In commercials and museum exhibits explaining to tourists how long we, Cherokee people, have existed in our homelands. How many hundred-year floods and thousand-year floods has this land seen in that time? Whatever math governs that past does not hold in this new era, in which I can live more than 40 years without experiencing a natural disaster, and then live through two cataclysmic floods within 2 years. On the morning of Thursday, September 26, 2024, I was in Asheville, and the rain had already begun. I learned from my Kentucky experience that I needed to have groceries at home and water, maps, rubber boots, and a full gas tank in my car. I also knew that I should stop by Biltmore Village to pick up my son's suit for his high school homecoming. Yes, I was still imagining that he could escort his friend onto the football field in a few days, maybe even attend the dance. Even as I prepared for a flood, I was sure I would not have to survive another one. Biltmore Village is notorious for flooding, even under mild rainy conditions, and when I arrived, part of the shopping area was already blocked off. I waited for the store to open. The rain continued to steadily fall. I watched a video on my phone, supposedly of the previous evening, of a car attempting to drive through floodwater just beyond the barricade I could see from my back window. I checked the weather maps again, I decided that my son wasn't going to need a suit anytime soon. I drove home thinking about how most people in western North Carolina had not seen the mattresses hanging from trees or known the people stranded on the other side of a creek by a washed-out bridge, as I had 2 summers ago. They hadn't smelled the gasoline in the air and watched boats float down Kentucky 160. I drove home unsettled by the thought that I would soon be comparing catastrophic flood experiences. I texted Josh and told him that he should leave. Come stay with me. Bring his dog. I knew that Scott's Creek he saw from his porch in Dillsboro might be calm still, but I also knew how troublesome a creek can become. He assured me that he wasn't worried. As I drove, I held on to the promise of these mountains, that, unlike many in eastern Kentucky, they had not been lopped off for strip mining by coal companies, the lack of vegetation allowing walls of water to cascade down them unrestricted. They did not contain coal slurry ponds teetering on the brink of collapse, spilling into the hollers below. Yet in my rear view on Interstate 40 and Route 74, I could see summer homes wedged into mountain slopes like Jenga pieces and far more economically fashioned homes dotting would-be flood plains. Creeks here don't rise like that, I assured myself. They don't wipe out western North Carolina communities. In the back of my mind was an image of Canton, North Carolina, underwater in 2021. Rare. Isolated. When the rain became mist and the world grayed into silence the day after losing all communication, I ventured out to check on Josh. He was cleaning his apartment, running dehumidifiers, and thanking friends who offered help. He was safe. His dog was safe. He pointed to a group of adults and children washing down the street with hoses and brooms. The children were covered in mud and barefoot. They're a church group, he explained. I thought back to the pickup truck that had pulled up to the house we were mucking out in Beulah, Kentucky, after their disaster. The man who hopped off the back was the son of the mayor of the next town over and offered us all tetanus shots to stave off the effects of hazardous waste in the floodwaters. I wondered if these church kids had had their shots, if their parents knew they might need one. As I write this, I don't know how all the cities and towns of western North Carolina are faring. I know that gas is scarce, and still none of us has a reliable cellular or Wi-Fi service. I know that the Dollar General is out of eggs. I know that rock slides cover some roads, and many others have crumbled. I know that the hospital in Cherokee cannot send patients to Asheville's Mission Hospital for critical care. I know that homes are gone and lives are gone. I know that my 11-year-old remarked on how the people who lived under the bridge have nowhere to go because the waters washed away their encampments. And I know that through all the rain and rise and wind, the roadside campaign signs survived, symbols of other promises. Promises that we can curb the tides of global warming. Promises that global warming doesn't exist. Promises that Appalachia is not forgotten. And I remember that promises don't do much, and rarely hold. They might help quell our fears, but these promise makers, too, don't know what they don't know. Promises are facades of safety that we make for ourselves, and that politicians often make for us in place of protective action. After the waters recede and connectivity returns, what is certain, what I know we can count on, is the tenacity of Appalachia. Faster than the floodwaters rose, the people of Kentucky began organizing for North Carolina. They began reaching out, checking in. I can almost feel them at the borders, pickup trucks loaded, hearts full. A week ago, they probably put out their own campaign signs, some red, some blue, yet they all recognized the white sign of surrender to Mother Nature, arriving to help long before promises from politicians have time to break. The thing is, Appalachia rarely fails to remember the small towns like Dillsboro. We're a holler people loyal to our mountain valleys, not afraid to stretch a helping hand beyond the city centers. And that's what it will take here. Metro areas like Asheville need an enormous amount of support, but so do more remote Appalachian communities. And if another flood comes, the people in these towns will care for the next. This fierce allegiance can only go so far. I fear that the world's choices are once again heralding disastrous consequences for the mountains we have protected for 10,000 years. But I also wonder how people here and in all the places beyond can repair the damage we've done. I guess it depends on what we choose to see beyond our own high ground, our state borders, our reliance on someone else's promises. Every community has to decide its own values, its own priorities. But sometimes circumstances dictate them and what promises we can keep. My son's school still held its homecoming dance on the Saturday following the flood. He didn't go. It's possible his suit is still underwater. Annette Sanuk Clapsaddle is a writer living in Cherokee, North Carolina. She is the author of Even As We Breathe. Our second story, the West has to believe that democracy will prevail. The Case Against Pessimism in Ukraine and Around the World by Anne Applebaum. This year's Atlantic staff writer Anne Applebaum was awarded the German Book Trade's Peace Prize for her indispensable contribution to the preservation of democracy. This article is adapted from the acceptance lecture for the Peace Prize that she delivered recently in Frankfurt. When I began working on the history of the Soviet Union in the 1990s, survivors and historians alike were free to speak as they wished. Many of them felt as if a new Russia could be constructed on top of the fundamental historical truths that were emerging. That possibility faded. I can even tell you the exact moment when it finally came to an end, the morning of February 20th, 2014, when Russian troops illegally marched across the Crimean Peninsula, which is part of Ukraine. That was the moment when the work of writing Russian history once again became dangerous, because that was the moment when the past and present collided, when the past became once again a blueprint for the present. No historian of tragedy ever wants to look up, turn on the television, and find their work has come to life. When in the 1990s I was researching the history of the Gulag in the Soviet archives, I assumed that the story belonged to the distant past. When, a few years later, I wrote about the Soviet assault on Eastern Europe, I also thought that I was describing an era that had ended. And when I studied the history of the Ukrainian famine, the tragedy at the center of Stalin's attempt to eradicate Ukraine as a nation, I did not imagine that this same kind of story could repeat itself in my lifetime. But in 2014, old plans were taken out of the same Soviet archives, dusted off, and put to use once again. The Russian soldiers who spread out across Crimea traveled in unmarked vehicles, wearing uniforms without insignia. They took over government buildings, removed the local leaders, barred them from their offices. For several days afterward, the world was confused. Were these separatists who were staging an uprising? Were they pro-Russian Ukrainians? I was not confused. I knew that this was a Russian invasion of Crimea, because it looked exactly like the Soviet invasion of Poland 70 years earlier. In 1944, the invasion featured Soviet soldiers wearing Polish uniforms, a Soviet-backed Communist Party pretending to speak for all Poles, a manipulated referendum, and other acts of political fakery that were designed to confuse not only the people of Poland, but also Poland's allies in London and Washington. After 2014, and then again after the full-scale Russian invasion of Ukraine in February of 2022, cruelly familiar patterns repeated themselves. Russian soldiers treated ordinary Ukrainians as enemies and spies. They used random violence to terrorize people. They imprison civilians for minor offenses, the tying of a ribbon with Ukrainian colors on to a bicycle, for example, or sometimes for no reason at all. They built torture chambers as well as filtration camps, which we also call concentration camps. They transformed cultural institutions, schools, and universities to suit the nationalist, imperialist ideology of the new regime. They kidnapped children, took them to Russia, and changed their identities. They stripped Ukrainians of everything that made them human and made them vital, that made them unique. In different languages at different times, this kind of assault has had different names. We used to talk about Sovietization. Now we talk about Russification. There is a German word, too, Gleichschaltung. But whatever word you use, the process is the same. It means the imposition of arbitrary autocratic rule. A state without the rule of law, without guaranteed rights, without accountability, without checks and balances. It means the destruction of all stirrings or survivals or signs of the liberal democratic order. It means the construction of a totalitarian regime. In Mussolini's famous words, everything within the state, nothing outside the state, nothing against the state. In 2014, Russia was already on the way to becoming a totalitarian society, having launched two brutal wars in Chechnya, having murdered journalists and arrested critics. But after 2014, that process accelerated. The Russian experience of occupation in Ukraine paved the way for harsher politics inside Russia itself. In the years after the Crimean invasion, opposition was repressed further. Independent institutions were completely banned. This deep connection between autocracy and imperial wars of conquest has a logic to it. If you truly believe that you and your regime have the right to control all institutions, all information, all organizations, that you can strip people not just of rights, but of identity, language, property, life, then of course you also believe that you have the right to inflict violence on whomever you please. Nor will you object to the human costs of such a war. If ordinary people have no rights, no power, no voice, then why should it matter whether they live or die? Not that this connection is nothing new. 2 centuries ago, Immanuel Kant, whose ideas inspired the prize, also described the link between despotism and war. More than 2 millennia ago, Aristotle wrote that a tyrant is inclined, quote, to foment wars in order to preserve his own monopoly of power, end quote. In the 20th century, Karl von Ossietzky, the German journalist and activist, became a fierce opponent of war, not least because of what it was doing to the culture of his own country. As he wrote in 1932, nowhere is there as much belief in war as in Germany. Nowhere are people more inclined to overlook its horrors and disregard its consequences. Nowhere is soldiering celebrated more uncritically. Since the invasion of Crimea in 2014, this same militarization has gripped Russia too. Russian schools now train small children to be soldiers. Russian television encourages Russians to hate Ukrainians, to consider them subhuman. The Russian economy has been militarized. Some 40% of the national budget will now be spent on weapons. To obtain missiles and ammunition, Russia now makes deals with Iran and North Korea, two of the most brutal dictatorships on the planet. The constant talk of war in Ukraine has also normalized the idea of war in Russia, making other wars more likely. Russian leaders now speak casually of using nuclear weapons against their other neighbors and regularly threaten to invade them. As in von Ossietzky's Germany, criticism of the war is not merely discouraged in Russia. It is illegal. My friend Vladimir Kara-Murza made the brave decision in 2022 to return to Russia and to speak out against the invasion from there. Why? because he wanted the history books to record that someone opposed the war. He paid a very high price. He was arrested. His health deteriorated. He was often kept in isolation. When he and others who had been unjustly imprisoned were finally released in exchange for a group of Russian spies and criminals, including a murderer taken from a German prison, his captors hinted that he should be careful, because in the future he might be poisoned. He had reason to believe them. Russian secret policemen had already poisoned him twice. Kara-Murza was not alone. Since 2018, more than 116,000 Russians have faced criminal or administrative punishment for speaking their mind. But what about the rest of us of the democratic world? Our voices are not restrained or restricted. We are not jailed or poisoned for speaking our mind. How should we react to the revival of a form of government that we thought had disappeared from Europe forever? In the early emotional days of the war in Ukraine, many did join the chorus of support. In 2022, as in 2014, Europeans again turned on their televisions to see scenes of a kind they only knew from history books. Women and children huddled at train stations, tanks rolling across fields, bombed out cities. In that moment, many things suddenly felt clear. Words quickly became actions. More than 50 countries joined a coalition to aid Ukraine militarily and economically, an alliance built at an unprecedented speed. But as the war has continued, doubt has crept in. Since 2014, faith in democratic institutions and alliances has declined dramatically in both Europe and America. Maybe our indifference to the invasion of Crimea played a larger role in this decline than we usually think. The decision to accelerate economic cooperation with Russia after the invasion certainly created both moral and financial corruption, as well as cynicism. That cynicism was then amplified by Russian disinformation campaign that we dismissed or ignored. Now, faced with the greatest challenge of our values and our interests in our time, the democratic world is starting to wobble. Many wish fighting in Ukraine would somehow magically stop. Others want to change the subject to the Middle East, another horrific, tragic conflict, but one where Europeans have almost no ability to shape events. A Hobbesian world makes many claims upon our resources of solidarity. A deeper engagement with one tragedy does not denote indifference to other tragedies. We must do what we can where our actions will make a difference. Slowly, another group is gaining traction, too, especially in Germany. These are the people who do not support or condemn Vladimir Putin's aggression, but rather pretend to stand above the argument and declare, "I want peace." Some even call for peace by referring solemnly to the lessons of German history. But "I want peace" is not always a moral argument. This is also the right moment to say that the lesson of German history is not that Germans should be pacifists. On the contrary, we have known for nearly a century that a demand for pacifism in the face of an aggressive advancing dictatorship can simply represent the appeasement and acceptance of that dictatorship. In 1938, German writer Thomas Mann, already in exile, horrified by the situation in his country and by the complacency of his liberal democracies, denounced the pacifism that brings about war instead of banishing it. During World War II, George Orwell condemned his compatriots who called upon Britain to stop fighting. "Pacifism," he wrote, "is objectively pro-fascist. This is elementary common sense. If you hamper the war effort of one side, you automatically help that of the other." In 1983, Manes Sperber, the recipient of that year's German Peace Prize, also argued against the false morality of his era's pacifists, who at the time wanted to disarm Germany and Europe in the face of the Soviet threat. "Anyone," he declared, "who believes and wants to make others believe that Europe without weapons, neutral and capitulating, can ensure peace for the foreseeable future is mistaken and is misleading others." We can use some of these words once again. Many of those in Germany and in Europe now call for Catholicism in the face of the Russian onslaught are indeed objectively pro-Russian, to borrow Orwell's phrase. Let me say it more clearly. Those who advocate pacifism and those who would surrender not just territory but people and principles to Russia have learned nothing at all from the history of the 20th century. To help prevent the Russians from spreading their autocratic political system further, we must help the Ukrainians achieve victory, and not only for the sake of Ukraine. The challenge is not only military. This is also a battle against hopelessness, against pessimism, and even against the creeping appeal of autocratic rule, which is also sometimes disguised beneath false language of peace. The idea that autocracy is safe and stable, that democracies cause war, that autocracies protect some form of traditional values while democracies are degenerate, this language is also coming from Russia and the broader autocratic world, as well as from those inside our own societies who are prepared to accept as inevitable the blood and destruction inflicted by the Russian state. Those who accept the erasure of other people's democracies are less likely to fight against the erasure of their own democracy. Complacency, like a virus, moves quickly across borders. Supporters of Ukraine are now asking Germany to provide weapons to be used against Russia, an aggressive military power. The true lesson of German history is not that Germans should never fight, but that Germans have a special responsibility to stand up and take risks for freedom. All of us in the democratic world, not just Germans, have been trained to be critical and skeptical of our own leaders and of our own societies, so it can feel awkward when we are asked to defend our most fundamental mental principles. In the face of an ugly, aggressive dictatorship in Europe, we in the democratic world are natural comrades. Our principles and ideals and the alliances we have built around them are our most powerful weapons. We must act upon our shared beliefs that the future can be better, the war can be won, that authoritarianism can be defeated once again, that freedom is possible, and that true peace is possible on this continent and around the world. This story has been edited slightly for time constraints, because we've run out of time for today's episode of The Atlantic. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Greg Cockcroft, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. The Atlantic is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.